Subscribe to the podcast and receive a new episode every day on your device.
Thank you. heard someone say, if I had his money, I would do things my way. How little they know, it's so hard to find one rich man in a hundred with a satisfied mind. Once I was waiting in fortune and fame, start in life's game, and then suddenly it happened. I lost every dime, but I'm richer by far with a satisfied mind. Is a pauper at times compared to the man with a satisfied mind. When my life is over and my time has run out, my friends and my loved ones, I'll leave, there's no doubt. But there's one thing for certain, when it comes my time, I'll leave this whole world with a satisfied mind.
By a nose, and I cried. No. Welcome to the Forum from the BBC World Service. I'm Bridget Kendall. In 1671, the Portuguese governor of what is now northeastern Brazil wrote to the Portuguese king about a relatively new group of settlements that had appeared in the interior of the country, away from the sugar plantations near the coast. Using the language of the period, he explained why he was concerned about the growth of these settlements in the colony, or captaincy, as it was then called.
The black slaves who fled the sugar mills of this captaincy have established numerous inland settlements between palmares and the forests where difficult access and lack of roads leave them better fortified by nature than they might be by human art. These settlements are growing daily, and their example induces other people to find freedom amid fertile land and the security of their own dwellings.
This group of settlements, now collectively known as Palmares, wasn't the only one of its kind, but it was the largest and lasted the longest. So why did it keep going for a century or more when so many other communities like it in Latin America vanished after a few years? Who were the people inhabiting it? And what is it about Palmares that means even today it remains iconic, a beacon of hope for many Brazilians? In this programme, we'll be looking for answers to these questions and tracing the story of Palmares. There's no reliable history of the settlements. Almost all the surviving documents about Palmares are from those intent on destroying it, hardly unbiased accounts. So to help us sift through what we do know, I'm joined by archaeologist Pedro Paulo Funari, professor at the University of Campinas in Brazil, Dr. José Ligna Nafafe, senior lecturer in Portuguese and Lusophone studies at Bristol University, and Maria Fernanda Escajon, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Oregon in the United States. Welcome to you all, and let's first put Palmares into historical context. By the 17th century, within 100 years of the first arrival of European colonists, Brazil was supplying most of the sugar exported to Europe from Latin America. It was grown on sugarcane plantations near the Brazilian coast. The plantation owners were Europeans, mostly Portuguese, but the workforce was made up of enslaved persons, to begin with, local Native Americans, but in time also many people brought in from Africa. Not surprisingly, many of the enslaved sought to escape from the plantations, some of them successfully. Pedro Paulo, do we have any idea how many people lived in Palmares and who they were?
Well, it's difficult to say because there are not so many data from this period. But anyway, most people consider that thousands of people went there from the coast fleeing slavery. At first, most of them were Native Americans who were enslaved. But later on, in the mid-17th century, a lot of African and Creoles, that is, descendants of Africans born in Brazil, fled also there. Furthermore, there were also persecuted people from the coast, from the Catholic areas, like considered as witches or whatever, and they also went there, according to the sources. So that we gather that some 30 to 50,000 people lived there. That's a huge amount, considering the population of Brazil in this period, that was 300,000 perhaps, and the number of slaves also 100,000. So it was a big state within a state.
Seeking to put distance between themselves and the plantations, the freedom seekers settled some 50 miles away in a long string of villages stretching perhaps 100 miles or so across northeastern Brazil. These were the settlements later to be known as Palmares. José, when you were there, did you get a sense of why they chose these particular locations?
The location, from what we know, it is very much a kind of a river area. I mean, if you go to Palmares now, Uniao in particular, you see the river that run through the region and so on. So those were the area that they were running in. But also, according to my own research as well, I think that those settlements were there because of the African connection with the natives. And that is the native Brazilians who were living in the area. The idea here is that, you know, running away to create settlement, you would need somebody to befriend you. So clearly the African who were running away weren't just running away for the sake of it, because they would be easily tracked down. So for them to do that, there must be somebody who was able to say, you know, this is where you stay, this is where it is safe to be. So for that, I mean, we have many settlements like that in Brazil, as there were also in Africa. We can't forget this, that, you know, in Angola, the enslaved Africans that were being captured were running away. In São Tomé, they were running away. In Cape Verde, they were running away too. So clearly, you know, these settlements represent what was already happening in Africa.
I should add that there are several different names used for these settlements. Some call them Mocambos, others speak of Quilombos, and you'll sometimes hear the freedom seekers being called Maroons, even though that's a term usually applied to people on Caribbean islands. But back to Brazil. Pedro Paulo, when do we have evidence for the earliest settlement in Palmares?
Well, the written sources, both Portuguese and Dutch, refer to the presence of these rebels since the late 16th century. The Portuguese already mentioned in the late 16th century. And the reason is the fact that the coast was already producing sugarcane in plantations since the 1560s, so that it was not that difficult to suppose that people were fleeing from the coast to the interior. Furthermore, as at least a third of the workforce was native Brazilians, we should say that they knew the terrain much better than the Portuguese, so that it was not that difficult to go to the hilly areas, a forest area that's called Zona da Mata, that's a forested area of difficult access. The only access was going via the rivers.
Starting in the 1630s, Dutch colonialists tried to wrest control of Brazil from Portugal. Their biggest success was in northeastern Brazil, then the most profitable part of the country, which they controlled for about two decades. And the Dutch felt so threatened by Palmares that they sent armed expeditions against the settlements. Reports from two such expeditions were published in the Netherlands in 1647. What did they tell us, Maria Fernanda?
Some of the written records that you mentioned depicted a series of very well-organized settlements that had around 5 or 6,000 inhabitants. And some accounts describe the population as very well-organized politically and militarily, and also speak of the presence of agricultural fields and of having domesticated animals. The records for one of those expeditions, the Bado expedition, speak of the killing of 100 palmarinos, of the capturing of several dozen people, of the destruction of the Quilombo strongholds. And importantly, the records from other later expeditions add that there was two big settlements there, that those settlements had several villages. Yet, I think it's really important to know that despite the damage inflicted by the Dutch, Palmares was not destroyed by these Viking excursions.
Now, we don't have any documents describing Palmares through the eyes of its inhabitants, and this has led to a long discussion among historians about who the people in the settlement actually were and where they came from. Pedro Paulo, sketch for us the different views on this issue.
Well, a key evidence here is the name of the places mentioned in the documentation, both Portuguese and Dutch, because they produce several names. Some of them are Tupi, native Brazilian names. Others are in Portuguese, but most of them are African, Bantu names. Then the second thing is that two of the names used to refer to the settlement, that is Mucambo and Quilombo, that were both used and are still used in Brazil until today, they refer to Bantu-speaking people names from Angola and Congo, Republic of Congo today. It means hut and also a separate settlement or camp, war camp, in the case of Quilombo. So we are sure that some of the main features of the settlement were African or rooted in Africa.
What do you think, Maria Fernanda?
I think we must remember that. At least for me, that Quilombos are not just fortified settlements that were just created by African descendants that were escaping from enslavement, that were created exclusively for military protection. I wanted to think of Quilombos also as a place that were important social, economic, and cultural dimensions to them. And yes, people were running away from something and finding refuge there. But if we think that Quilombos were also a place where people were running to, they were building lives, they were building social networks, they were building families and new economic relationships, you can think of a broader set of people of different populations besides those of Angolan descent that were building these settlements together.
So what was life in the settlements like? Some descriptions of the settlements speak of them being fortified by palisades, encircled by booby traps, and defended by heavily armed men. What else do we know about life in Palmares? José?
They were very well sustained economically. They tilled their land, they trade with their neighbours, and they do many other things that would say were normal. And this is what the document were saying. But also politically, they were very well organised. They have a leader. But the other thing I think is very important too here to understand as far as what Palmares was like. The document were written by the people who were attempting to sort of destroy them. You know, they would say in the document that the Palmaristas were very much stealing from their neighbours. They were taking, you know, some of the Portuguese properties. But the more I read those things, the more I think they were politically used, because when in Angola, the Portuguese, when they were attempting to destroy some of the region in Angola, in particular to do with Bongo and Ndongo at that time, they used a similar language. What we have to understand here is this was a language used politically in order to give them the license to be able to wage war against the community.
Given the lack of documents about the settlements, or at least reliable documents, has archaeology been able to give us a more detailed picture of life in Palmares? Pedro Paulo?
Yes, very much so. There were native Brazilian wares found there. There were also glazed wares produced probably by common people in the coast, proving that there was a lot of communication between these colonists, not the planters, but the colonists and the people in the maroon, and also evidence of a widespread presence of native remains in the area, prehistoric remains, proving, again, that the area was well known and inhabited by native Brazilians. And furthermore, it was possible to say that the settlement was linked to a global system because there were importation of material from elsewhere, and they were also part of international trade. They were traded as enslaved, but also they participated in this way, even if struggling against the plantations.
And what does it actually look like? Is it on a hill? Is it flat?
This is a belly hill. That is a very difficult hill to access. There is also some kind of protection by the environment, so that it's not easy to have access. And there is also a lake, and it was enabled, this lake enabled people to have access to water without going to the Mundaú River, so that it was very protected. We can still understand how protected it is, the site.
Those living in the settlements had very little access to capital or tools. So how did they survive, José?
I think the documents that we are reading seems to indicate that they were having access, contrary to what might have happened elsewhere. They were having access to certain tools, and not, of course, you know, we don't know in terms of number how many, what were the quality of those tools, but they were having access to certain tools because they were exchanging goods with the neighboring Portuguese, and they were exchanging gold with the neighbors and so on. What the document were saying, that their neighbors who were Portuguese, who were living in the region, were also being asked to pay tax to the Palmaristas. What that tax involved, we don't really know, but we know that they were paying something. And what the Palmaristas were doing, these runaway enslaved were doing in that region, they give protection to those Portuguese, their neighbors, who were paying this tax to them. In other words, we are not going to attack you. Or if anything comes in terms of any enemy that come to attack you or us, we are going to protect you. So clearly, if this was the case, if the document are to be believed, then clearly they were having access to some tools. But there are other cases too. We know from the writing of Rocha Pita, who was an historian of Bahia at that time, his father was a captain. We don't know whether his father was part of the group that went to destroy Palmares, but he has written extensively about the life of Palmaristas in Palmares. One of the other things he said, the reason Palmares was destroyed was because they ran out of munitions. Now, to run out of munitions meant they have firearms. So in other words, these people have access to firearms at that time to fight the Portuguese. So which meant their network was far wider than we are actually led to believe.
There's a lot of discussion about the social structure of the settlements, how hierarchical or centralised they may have been. What can we glean from the documents we have, Maria Fernanda?
From both the records, the archaeological records and the archival ones, as my colleagues have already noted, the settlements were very well organised politically. Some documents refer to the existence of hierarchies among Palmares inhabitants and even the presence of a leader, and some of them even refer to him as a king or a great lord. And many scholars suggest that Palmares' features actually replicated African or Bantu forms of social and political and military organization. And as I mentioned before, Palmares was not just one single settlement, but rather it was a group of enclaves, and there's some discussion regarding how centralized or how hierarchical these settlements were. So some mention the existence of labor specialization, for instance, or the different roles of rulers and servants, and even the presence of enslaved individuals. But I think the issue with these reports is that they all have been created by Europeans who looked for similarities, real or imagined, with the social structures they knew. So when they were explaining what Palmares was about and the Palmares realities that they saw, they were kind of explaining them according to their own views. And one must question how likely it was that they could have recognized and described the social order that was radically different from their own.
Here is an extract from a report, most likely written by a Portuguese official in the 1670s, about the ruler of Palmares.
They acknowledge that a man called Ganga Zumba is the master and ruler of both the natives of Palmares and of the people who moved into the town from elsewhere. He has his own palace, as well as houses for family members, and they are protected by guards and served by officials, as royal residences would normally be. He commands the kind of reverence a king would. When people find themselves in his presence, they kneel down and clap their hands as a sign of respect. They address him as Majesty and obey him.
By the mid-1670s, Palmares was so well established and it was so integrated into the local economy that many traders and smallholders near the coast wanted to conclude an official truce with the settlements. But the plantation owners had other ideas, especially after Pedro de Almeida became the new governor of the Brazilian province of Pernambuco in 1674. Tell us what happened, Pedro Paolo.
They were worried by the rebel state, so they decided to hire a specialist, a slave raider. That is, people who were very fierce. They had in their company not only Portuguese, but mostly native Brazilians, enslaved native Brazilians and Africans, enslaved Africans. And in this case, it was the case of Fernão Carrilho. This was well known in the whole north of Brazil, in this area, the whole large area, because he had been fighting native Brazilians, fleeing slaves, and also against other people, other rebels. So that they decided to hire him, and he was quite successful because he was very fierce and harsh and very effective with the large troops. This led to the fact that he was able to attack Palmares continually from 1677 until 1686.
The Portuguese thought that the Carrillo expeditions had sufficiently weakened Palmares and decided to offer them a peace treaty. We'll get to the treaty in a moment, but first I wanted to ask about a small but telling detail. The negotiation required interpreters. And what does that tell us about the languages and cultures that existed in Palmares and more broadly in 17th century Pernambuco? Pedro Paolo.
Well, several languages were spoken in Brazil in this period. In the coast, it was Portuguese. For a while, it was Dutch when the Dutch dominated the area, but otherwise it was Portuguese. But this was only in the coast, in the small fringe area between the coast and, let's say, 30 to 40 miles from the coast. Otherwise, in the backlands, in the interior of the continent, the common language was Tupi language. This Tupi, native Brazilian language, was a communication, a coine or lingua franca, used by everybody, including the slave raiders. But there was also the introduction of different Bantu languages. So that was a complex situation. But in the case specifically of the agreement you mentioned, it was revealing the fact that the slave raiders were only able to communicate with the Portuguese people in the coast because they used translators or interpreters called the lingua. The name of the period in Portuguese was lingua, that is, someone who can interpret from one language to the other. So this is very revealing of the very complex picture, not only in Palmares, but also in the country as a whole.
Regardless of the outcome of the multilingual peace negotiations, the Carrillo attacks were a serious setback for Palmares. So the Portuguese thought this was a good moment to conclude a treaty that would eliminate the threat once and for all. In 1678, they invited representatives of the Palmares leader, Ganga Zumba, for negotiations. And the arrival of the delegation in the local capital drew a lot of attention, as this contemporary description suggests.
These people arrived virtually naked, just their groins covered with pieces of cloth and animal skins. As they progressed into the town, they were led by Ganga Zumba's eldest son, who rode on a horse and who had been injured in the war.
The negotiations, both in person and later through letters, lasted for months. And José, what was the outcome?
What the Portuguese were attempting to do was clearly to negotiate with the Palmarises as if they were conquered. The Portuguese wanted Palmares to stop their activity, return the runaway enslaved, we stop the war, and that people stop running. But that negotiation didn't have a very fruitful kind of outcome. Yes, there was an attempt where peace was being agreed, but eventually that peace was constantly broken, because they realized very clearly that by accepting that is to accept the outcome of being conquered. And that is not what they were interested in.
The leader of the settlers, known to us as Ganga Zumba, accepted the peace treaty. But a significant fraction, possibly a majority, of the inhabitants of Palmares, under the leadership of a man known as Zumbi, rejected it. José, what happened next?
The Ganga Zumba faction was very much at that time, yes, we accepted the Portuguese terms, but Zumbi didn't agree with it. The understanding here is that Zumbi, who, when he was a young boy, if the myth is to be believed, he was brought up by the priest. So in other words, he understood the way of life of the Portuguese and so on. So he could perhaps understand far better than what Ganga Zumba would have understood. In other words, the perception of understanding that this agreement did not mean much. So he represented that angle, that having agreement with Portuguese is not really what Palmaristas should be going for. But like any other society, like any other community, you tend to have the faction, different opinion politically. People have a different vision of how they wanted to sort of lead their community.
One of the stipulations in the treaty was that the settlers in Palmares should give up their land and move to less fertile area closer to the coast. It would seem that some of them did just that. Do we know what happened to them, Pedro Paulo?
Yes, we do. They went to the Cucaú River. That's not a good area to settle. And later on, they were killed or enslaved again. This reinforced the idea of Zumbi and his followers that it was not possible to have any compromise with the Portuguese, that these compromises, these so-called treaties, were